Hello and welcome to our micronutrients presentation on calcium. Calcium is one of those minerals that we hear a lot about, and everybody, even in the lay press, knows really what calcium is all about, but do they really know what calcium is all about? So we're going to present to you the details, the behind-the-scenes details on this very, very important mineral in our body, not just for bone health, but for so much more. So as usual, before we start, I always like to let you know that everything I present here is education, and everything you present to your clients is in the spirit of education. It's not ever intended to replace the one-on-one care from a qualified medical professional, and it's never really medical advice. So good thing for you to do to start your presentations with as well. So let's talk about calcium. We'll start with some general stuff about calcium. It's what's considered a macro mineral. And as a reminder, the macro minerals are those minerals that we need in large quantities. So for example, we need calcium in multi-milligram doses, right? So 500 milligrams, 1,000 milligrams. So we need it in large amounts as compared to, say, something like iodine, where maybe we need 150 micrograms. So we need a lot of calcium in the body, and it makes up the critical mass of the skeletal system, right? About 99% of all the calcium in the body is stored in the bones and teeth. But that doesn't discount its critical role to survival, its critical role in, guess what, heart contractility. So we need to be keeping a very tight range of blood calcium in order to be alive even. So the body doesn't allow that level to go much out of balance because it could be deadly. And that makes it difficult for us to use the blood calcium as an indicator, does the person have enough? Are they eating enough? Are they storing enough? And that we'll see later when we look at assessments that unfortunately we can't use the blood calcium as an indicator for our overall calcium status. But it's so critical to survival, right? It's so critical to the heart and contractility and all the other functions that it does regarding smooth and skeletal muscle that the body will actually break down its bones. You'll basically eat away at the bones in order to get enough calcium into the blood to maintain the right level. And that becomes a problem for a lot of women, a huge percentage of women over the age of 50 who are diagnosed with either osteopenia or osteoporosis. So what does calcium do overall in a nutshell? We'll go into this a lot more. It helps the muscles to move. It helps the nerve to carry the messages and transmissions from one part to the other. So it helps in neurotransmission. It helps blood vessels to move blood through the body, and that's through contractility of the muscle walls. And it helps to release hormones and enzymes that affect almost every bodily function. So quite interesting, all the different things calcium does. It's not just about bone health. Bone health is critical, obviously, as 99% of all the calcium is related to the bone, but calcium is so much more than just bone health. And the name is derived from a Latin name, calx, meaning lime, and there is a reason for that. So let's look at the chemistry of calcium. It's the 20th element in the periodic table, and the symbol is Ca. Y'all know that, you've seen it. But there's different nomenclatures that you're going to see for calcium when it's expressed in chemical reactions or in chemical formulas. It's one of the group 2 metals, and it's noted as an alkaline earth metal. Okay, and when we said lime, it's because so much calcium is coming from limestone in the earth. The ionized form of calcium is Ca2+, and it's what's called a hard cation. Okay, so cations donate electrons, so it's a positive, right? So 2+ means it's got a charge of 2 extra protons, basically, two less electrons, however you want to look at it. It's the 5th most abundant element by mass in the Earth's crust and in seawater. So seawater is actually a great source of calcium, as are the vegetables that are grown in seawater. It's silver gray metal, and it's the lightest of all metals, so its atomic weight tends to be lower than the other metals. It's widely distributed as limestone, which is calcium carbonate, CO3, which is kind of interesting when we think about calcium carbonate in a supplement. We don't really think about it as being limestone, right? I have limestone in my backyard. I have limestone in rocks around the yard and the pool. And actually, the calcium carbonate is limestone. Quicklime, which is another form, and then calcium fluoride. And calcium fluoride is bound with fluorine. It reacts with both air and water. So it's not an inert metal, it reacts with both air and water. So let's take a look at calcium in our living organisms. We're not the only people, the only species that needs calcium. It's found in all organisms, living and dead, because it's a metal, right? Calcium, the ion Ca2 plus, plays an essential role in a bunch of functions that are critical to life. Signal transductions, moving a signal from one part of the body to the other, neurotransmission, muscle function, that's both skeletal and smooth muscle function, and smooth muscle would be the visceral kind of muscle, the muscles around the organs and the blood vessels, and then enzymatic functions. Most of the bones are made up of calcium phosphate. So that's calcium with PO4 phosphate, two of those together. So you got PO4, and then that nomenclature of the M in parentheses, it means a calcium bound to a PO4, PO4, phosphorus and four oxygens. So there's two groups of a phosphorus with four oxygens plus calcium, and that's mostly what makes up the bones. So let's take a look at how calcium is regulated in the body. So there's hormonal control of calcium, and then there's digestive absorption control of calcium. So in the neck, surrounding the thyroid gland, are four little tiny glands called the parathyroid glands. And they really are not related to thyroid function. They are not related to tyrosine and T4 and T3 and all that. They are separate glands in and of themselves. They produce a hormone called parathyroid hormone. Parathyroid hormone causes an increase in calcium absorption and the vitamin D hydroxylation by the kidneys, which helps in the calcium absorption. So it increases, basically, increase in parathyroid hormone is going to cause an increase of calcium in the blood. So it can cause calcium reabsorption from bones and calcium absorption, increased absorption through the GI tract. Okay? So that's basically how it's regulated. There's also in the thyroid itself, it's going to produce another hormone called calcitonin. We're going to look at that in a moment. And then there's calcitriol, which is another name for vitamin D. So these are all the things that help it to function. And we'll look at absorption in just a bit. Before we do that, I want to go through a few of the functions that calcium goes through. It acts as what's called a second messenger in cell signaling pathways. And it's really important for getting the message down from cell to cell so there's intracellular communication. It also is important in the constriction and the relaxation of blood vessels. Remember, we talked about how it's important in muscle contraction, not just skeletal muscle or skeletal muscle, however you want to say it, but in smooth muscle, which is the blood vessels and the cardiac and around other glands and organs. So we'll look at that in more detail. It's important for transmission of nerve signals, nerve impulses. It's important for the secretion of insulin. It's important for the strength of the skeleton, obviously, because 99% of our calcium is going to be stored at the teeth and the bones. So calcium is the main thing that's involved, but there's way more than just calcium involved in bone strength. There's about 21 different nutrients that are involved with having healthy bones. So the whole fascination, if you will, and the focus on calcium in the mainstream for the purpose of bone strength is missing a lot of that in action. Calcium helps to stabilize proteins and enzymes, so it will be very important in the immune system as a result, in the digestive system as a result. Super important for heart activity, and that's one of the main reasons I believe that the calcium regulation in the blood is so important, because it controls the contract-relax cycle of the heart. Okay, so we don't want to end up with the heart not beating, not having the regular rhythm, which would happen if the calcium got off. So the body has this innate mechanism to keep the calcium in the blood in a very tight range. But what is that at the expense of? It's going to be at the expense of the strength of the bones. And neuromuscular transmission, so in addition to just the transmission of signals from nerve to nerve, it is the transmission of signals from the nerves to the muscles, right, at those junctions. And we'll look at that in a picture in a little bit. It's also important for blood pressure and peripheral blood flow. Okay, so if there's too much calcium contracting down the blood vessels, then we're going to have increased blood pressure. So we're going to talk later about how calcium needs to be in very, very strict proportion to magnesium. Calcium does the contraction, and this is a simplification, but calcium contracts, magnesium relaxes. Let's look at a few more of the functions, and this is just a list. Some of these have already been mentioned. But muscle contraction, heartbeat regulation, nerve impulse conduction, neurotransmitter function, cardiovascular system, so the blood vessels and the heart itself, the division of the cells, immune function, even the production of saliva, calcium plays a role, and in the enzyme activity, the activation of some of the enzymes in the body. So let's take a look at a picture of what happens at the neuromuscular junction and how calcium gets involved. So when we want to tell the muscle to contract, there's what's called an action potential, which is transmitted along the nerve to the neuromuscular junction, the junction where that nerve meets the muscle. And then at the neuromuscular junction, a neurotransmitter that gets released that acts on there is acetylcholine, ACH. It binds to the receptors on the muscle and opens up the sodium ion channels that leads to an action potential. So basically, it opens up the ion channels, which causes the potential that goes down the tubule in the muscle and then gets into the bone where the calcium is released. And it goes in to troponin, and that's these filaments that are in the muscles. And there's actin and myosin. We'll look at that in the next picture. But that filament in the muscle then shortens, right? So that the calcium causes the shortening of that filament in the troponin, the tubules within the muscle. Then the muscle contracts. When the muscle contracts, it then pulls on the bone and moves the bone, and you get action. So if we look at that in a little bit closer detail, we've got this troponin, we've got an actin filament, and we've got tropomyosin. And then we've got the calcium, which latches onto the binding site and causes the contraction of the muscle. So it's really important to have the right amount of calcium. A couple of things that can happen if there's too much calcium in relationship to magnesium, what happens is that calcium causes muscle to go into what's called tetany, which is that it's a sustained muscle contraction. That happens to a lot of folks when they have a muscle cramp in the middle of the night, wake up in the middle of the night. Everybody says, well, maybe you're low in magnesium, and the magnesium will help to relax that. Sometimes massaging magnesium oil into that muscle when it's gone into contraction. So we always want to look at, why is that happening? Is it a deficiency of magnesium or a poor absorption of magnesium or excess calcium being released from the bone, or too much calcium intake? And a lot of people are taking way too much calcium in relationship to their magnesium. The U.S. keeps raising the RDA of calcium up and up and up. When we look at other countries where they don't eat as much rich food and protein-rich food and acid-forming foods in the diet, they don't need anywhere near as much calcium. They're getting like 500 milligrams of calcium a day, and that's plenty. And there are a lot of people just downing calcium pills with the idea that if a little is good, more is better. I want to have really strong bones. And it's actually not doing them any good. It can actually be putting them in a state of calcium hypercalcemia or hypercalciuria, which we'll look at later, as these are serious problems. So it's really important when you're talking to your clients that you ask them what they're taking, what supplements are they taking, not just the individuals, but calculate up all of the different sources they have of, say, calcium versus magnesium, and make sure the ratio isn't completely out of whack. It's not uncommon for somebody to be taking a calcium supplement that's, say, 1,400 milligrams or 1,500 milligrams, or even to take 2,800 milligrams a day, and then also to be getting some of it in their multivitamin or their multimineral, and then on top of that, eating it in their food. So you can get too much calcium. There is. It's not generally going to happen based on getting it from food. But if you combine high calcium foods with a lot of the supplements, which people tend to be overdosing on, it can get people into trouble. So let's look further. Calcium is involved in the production of some of the hormones that are involved in digestion, energy, and fat metabolism. We also already looked at insulin, and it is involved in the production of several other hormones. If you're looking at, like, somebody's having an imbalance, say they're having an imbalance in their gut. Now, we don't have specific ways to measure each and every gut hormone and say, oh, yeah, well, secretin is low or CCK is high. But if you're looking at somebody who's having digestive issues, you may be looking at, is there a calcium deficiency or a calcium excess that might be causing the body to make too little or too much of those hormones? Remember, we're always about digging and asking curious questions. So these presentations are intended to give you the backstory, the understanding of what all is involved in this particular case where calcium is involved, so that your thought processes go here when you're in a situation where you're trying to solve a case and it's really confusing as to what might be going on. So don't discount excess calcium as one of the reasons for some of these other problems in digestion, energy, or fat metabolism. It's important for the transport of nutrients and other substances across cell membranes. And here's the deal, it interacts with sodium. We saw in that pump with the actomycin that it interacts with sodium and opens up those channels. So it interacts with sodium, potassium, and magnesium to keep the blood pressure and the water balance. So whenever we're looking at a particular set of symptoms, when we're doing a case history, and we come up with, oh, this person has high blood pressure, we want to make sure that their calcium-magnesium ratios are looked at to rule them out or in as a potential culprit in this issue. So how does calcium get digested? Well, it's present in food and usually in insoluble salts. So it's bound to salts, usually not soluble, soluble, but then it's solubilized, so it exists as the free calcium ions, the Ca2+. In about a half an hour, these are released at an acidic pH. So it's really important for the calcium to get released from the insoluble salts that it's bound to in the food and also in the supplements. It's very important to have good HCL function. And one of the biggest scams, misnomers, misinformations that are out there now is, oh, you have problems with calcium. Oh, you have osteoporosis. Take Tums, because Tums is a very inexpensive source of calcium. But it's calcium carbonate, number one, which is a very alkaline form of calcium, and it's very hard to get absorbed. It's one of the lowest absorption. We'll look at that in a little while. But on the other hand, you're alkalizing the stomach. You're neutralizing the stomach acid. So these calcium molecules that are attached to these insoluble salts are not going to be released. It has to be an acidic environment, and it takes about an hour at an acidic pH to get absorbed. So calcium is not that easy to get absorbed in a supplemental form because of this. Like, if the supplement goes through the system pretty quickly and you're not taking it with food, the pH of the stomach is not going to be so acidic. So if it leaves the stomach relatively quickly, it might be very much part of it, might still be bound in the insoluble salts. And those insoluble calcium salts can get deposited in various other places in the body. Okay, so it's really, I think, important that you make sure that somebody's taking calcium supplements, that they do take it with food, and that they don't take it with alkalizing agents, that they have good stomach acid, and that they take it hopefully with a food that's going to take a little longer to get out of their stomach. So, for example, like orange juice is supposed to be a good source of calcium, and it is compared to other fruits. But if you eat oranges or drink orange juice, it's not going to be in the stomach long enough to be solubilized and broken out and taken away from its carrier. So what you want to do is make sure that you're eating something, like, say, I would eat calcium with, say, a protein or fat kind of foods. So it could be a salad, but as long as you've got, you know, avocado or some pumpkin seeds or hemp seeds on that salad to give it the more protein and fat, that's going to really help the calcium in that food, as well as if you're taking a separate calcium, to be in the stomach longer so that it has a full hour at the acidic pH to be able to be absorbed. So it's just little things. And this is where I want you to teach you how to think, not just how to memorize things, right? So you can learn this and you can say, yeah, it requires. But when you think things through, you end up coming up with, oh, what can I tell somebody about how they can best take calcium or eat calcium-rich foods or whatever the thing is, when you know how it works. So I want you to always be thinking about how you can apply what I'm teaching you in these presentations. What I want you to know, though, is solubilization doesn't mean better absorption. The free calcium, once it's freed, can bind to other dietary constituents, and that can limit its bioavailability. So if you can get calcium in ionized form and take it on an empty stomach, you should be able to get that to be absorbed, a good part of it through the stomach lining and part of it as it goes down through the system, when it's not competing with other dietary constituents for bioavailability and when you don't have to worry about the solubilization. So there are some supplements like that that would be helpful for people to be taking. So let's look at the absorption. There's two general mechanisms. Whenever the calcium intake is low, it's transported actively, transcellularly, between cells. And it's located largely in the duodenum and upper jejunum. So that's where most of the absorption happens, which is unusual because most of our food, right, we think about food being absorbed mostly in the jejunum. So in the duodenum and the upper part of the jejunum is where this calcium absorption is going to take place via active transport. So when the intake is low, it's like, this is true for most of our minerals and nutrients, that whenever the intake is low, the body is actively working to take it in. It's actively working to pull it across a gradient where what's inside the blood is less than what's outside the blood. So it's very much higher when the calcium intake is low. When the calcium intake is high, it just reduces it to a passive form. So if you do have somebody taking high-dose calcium, it would be a good idea to split it across a day. So not just to take it all in the morning or all in the afternoon, but to split it across the day so there's never that large amount that forces a lower absorption rate. Okay? And the passive absorption does occur throughout the intestine. So transport. How does calcium get transported throughout the body? Well, about 40% of it is bound to the proteins albumin and prealbumin, and they're just carried around that way. 10% of it is carried around by either sulfate, phosphate, or citrate, okay? So it's 10% of it, that's the way that's transported, but 50% is just free in the blood, just free calcium in the blood. From the blood, it then gets deposited into the bone, okay? As long as we've got a good alkaline, overall alkaline pH, which the blood is supposed to be 7.35 to 7.45. If that alkaline pH starts to drop down, calcium is going to be required to bring it back up. So we've got two mechanisms that are causing the bone to be broken down into calcium, to have free calcium in the blood. One is that the blood levels start to dip, and that's dangerous for the cardiac function, so we need to bring it back up. And the other is that the pH of the blood starts to dip, and again, that's dangerous for just about everything. And so we trigger increased absorption of the calcium, but also breakdown of the bones. So let's talk about how concentrations of calcium are maintained in the blood. So there's the intracellular and extracellular concentration that we have to look at. And there's a number of hormones that will be working here. The blood levels are maintained between 8.5 and 10.5 milligrams per deciliter, and that's U.S. numbers. You'd have to convert that to standard international to find out if it's millimoles per liter. Also, optimal, if we look at our blood chemistry software, optimal is more like between 9 and 10, so a tighter range. But the blood levels are not indicative of optimal levels in bone, and I want to really enforce that and really emphasize that. You cannot tell that a person is not at risk for osteoporosis just because their blood levels are fine. Most people you're going to see are going to have normal blood levels of calcium. So how do we control the extracellular calcium? Well, we touched on this a little while ago, and we'll go into each of these in a little bit more detail. We've got the parathyroid hormones, and they secrete parathyroid hormone, no surprise, which helps to raise the level of calcium in the blood. We've got calcitriol, which is vitamin D, which helps to raise the level of calcium. And calcitonin, which is secreted by the thyroid and actually causes the calcium to go down. So let's look at each of those. Parathyroid hormone, secreted by the parathyroid glands in response to low calcium. There are calcium sensing receptors that monitor both the calcium and the magnesium. And when it gets too low, it increases the extracellular calcium through the bone and the kidney. So that's what happens with parathyroid. When the calcium sensing receptors look to see that the calcium levels are going down or the ratios are going off, they'll secrete the parathyroid hormone, which then regulates the reabsorption of calcium. So it triggers the reabsorption of calcium from the bone, the reabsorption in the kidney. So calcium isn't excreted in the urine, it's pulled back into circulation. And then it increases the activation of vitamin D to calcitriol. So vitamin D, the active form, the D3, is calcitriol. Calcitriol will then cause the absorption of calcium in the intestines. So it promotes the mobilization of calcium ions from the bones. So whenever we need more calcium in the blood, we're absorbing more from the intestines and we're mobilizing it from the bone matrix. That's not a good thing. We don't want that. Now, sometimes when we check people, they have high calcium in the blood. And generally speaking, I'm concerned when I see high calcium. It's not like, oh, this person's good. They've been doing their bone building things and they're not at risk for osteoporosis. No, when the calcium is high in the blood, I'm suspecting that something's going wrong in the parathyroid. So if ever you're seeing high concentrations of calcium in the blood, then you want to suspect parathyroid. One of the things that you can do with that is to do something called an ionized calcium level, and you can also check parathyroid hormones. Oftentimes, there are benign tumors on the parathyroid hormone that cause them to produce too much calcitriol, causes breakdown of the bones more, and causes the calcium to go up in the blood. Not a good situation. You might look at it and think, oh, yeah, that's good. They've got plenty of calcium. But no, it's actually not a good sign. Okay? So calcitonin is secreted by the parafollicular cells of the thyroid, the cells around the thyroid follicles, and it opposes parathyroid. So if the calcium levels get too high, the calcitonin should come in and bring it back down. They haven't been able to see, if it's physiologically significant in terms of keeping it the balance. I don't think anybody really measures calcitonin. I haven't seen that. I haven't never seen anybody get it measured on a blood test. But in theory, it's that balance, right? It's the parathyroid calcitonin. Increased parathyroid causes the body to retain more and pull out more calcium from the bones and raise the calcium serum level. Calcitonin will then sense that the calcium levels are too high and then cause it to drop down. So let's look at calcium pumps. What are calcium pumps? What the heck are those? Well, they are a family of transporters of ions that are found in the cell membranes. And they're responsible for the calcium going into and out of the cell, the active transport of the calcium, and also for maintaining that steep electrochemical gradient across the cell membrane. So, right, we want to maintain that higher calcium levels on the outside. Calcium pumps play a crucial role in the cells signaling to each other. It keeps the intracellular, the calcium in the cell, to be 10,000 times lower than the extracellular, right? So we have not just a little bit more calcium outside the cell than inside, but 10,000 times more calcium on the outside of the cell than the inside. And that's what these pumps, these ion transporters do. When you have a plasma membrane calcium, ionized calcium and ATPase enzyme. In the plasma membrane, we have a calcium ATPase enzyme that controls this. It's the main regulator of how much of the ionized calcium gets into the cells. It is the transport protein in the plasma membrane. So you have the plasma membrane of the cells, and you have this transporter called calcium ATPase. And that helps with the exchange of ions, removes the calcium from the inside of the cell, and maintains that gradient that we just mentioned of 10,000 times more calcium on the outside than the inside. So how do we get rid of excess calcium? Well, it's excreted in the urine and the feces. It can be eliminated by the skin when somebody's sweating a lot. So if you're out in the Texas heat and you're walking or running or hiking, you're going to sweat a lot. If you do a lot of it, extreme sweating, you can lose up to 182 milligrams a day. That's quite a substantial load. The average is 60 milligrams a day excreted. So there has to be this constant influx of calcium because we do excrete a lot. The urinary calcium losses range from 100 to 240 milligrams per day. And remember that when the body senses that the blood levels of calcium are going lower, it decreases that loss and increases the reabsorption in the kidney tubules. It's heavily influenced by sodium excretion. So we're going to look at the interactions between calcium and other electrolytes and minerals in a little while, but we'll talk more about that at that point. So what influences calcium absorption? Well, things that decrease it are leaky gut and other GI issues, especially inflammation in the gut. Oxalates in the food, and oxalates, oxalic acid, it's an organic acid that's found in some foods, and particularly high in spinach and rhubarb and chard. And the oxalates are found in just about every food, so they're not evil, they're not bad, but they tend to bind to calcium and take it out. So if you were to look at, say, the spinach label on your box of spinach, and it says that there's 250 milligrams of calcium in every serving, it's also got a fair amount of oxalic acid. So the oxalates are going to bind to a portion of that calcium and take it out. So if you're relying on foods that are high in oxalates, like spinach and chard, then for the calcium, you're going to have to take in a lot more calcium-rich foods in non-oxalic acid. Now, there are some people who are sensitive to oxalates in that they have a leaky gut. The oxalate molecules get into the bloodstream, and then they can wreak havoc in all kinds of places, in particular in the kidneys and in the formation of kidney stones. So oxalates can bind calcium. Phytates that are found in wheat bran and some of the dried beans, phytic acid is another acid that binds to the calcium to pull it out. Not quite as strong as oxalic acid or oxalates, but definitely that. So if you've got a person who's eating a lot of breads and grains and things like that, you're going to find that even though they may be taking in a lot of calcium, they're not getting as much as you think they are. If you start to take more than 500 milligrams of calcium a day, then you're going to see, or at a time, you're going to see a decrease in the absorption. So it would be at a time. So you take 500 milligrams of calcium. Instead of it being, say, it's 80% absorbed, if you had taken a lower dose, maybe it's only 30% absorbed. And don't quote me on those exact numbers. If you want those exact numbers, you can go to our textbook, which goes into that in more detail. If you take too much sodium, so too much salt intake is going to pull out the calcium. So it has to do with the sodium-calcium channels, okay, those ion potentials. High phosphorus intake, and a lot of people get a lot of phosphorus who drink soft drinks. Even if they're diet soft drinks, they're still going to be high in phosphorus. And also meat is high in phosphorus. So a lot of people have a high phosphorus diet, and they have these oxalates and phytates in their diet, and they have a much more acidic pH, and they need to neutralize it, and they're losing calcium. So it's really important. And of course, our nemesis is for just about everything, which is smoking and alcohol. So what can you do to increase calcium absorption? Well, you can take it along with nutrients that are going to help support it, like magnesium, vitamin D3, vitamin K, vitamin C, vitamin E, boron, and potassium. And these are all going to help increase the absorption of calcium, and thereby they're going to increase the body's ability to make bone. So a combination of these is very important if you're working with somebody with osteopenia or osteoporosis, as well as looking to make sure that they are minimizing those calcium inhibitors, that we just talked about, the phytates, the oxalates, healing the leaky gut, etc., and then not taking too much at the same time. Let's look at some more things that deplete calcium. Gluten. Gluten causes leaky gut. Gluten causes aggravation to the gut. We know that interferes with calcium absorption. Gluten also contains phytates. Gluten is also inflammatory, so it causes issues with inflammation in various parts of the body and can affect the calcium. An acid-forming diet. So what we mean by that is if you look at the pH balance, the residue of food, that you want the foods to be more on the alkaline side. I always tell my clients to go for 80% of their food being on the alkaline side. And sometimes I'll have them go on a, 90 to 100% alkaline forming for a temporary period to get their balance restored. Processed foods and overly cooked foods can deplete minerals or be depleted in minerals, and those go together, depleting minerals and being depleted of minerals. And so those should be avoided or minimized. Alcohol and tobacco all affect calcium in the body. They decrease its absorption and pull it out of the body. Herbicides and pesticides also. And anything sugary like refined sugar, corn syrup, artificial sweeteners. Stress, a good old stress. We know that stress affects just about every nutrient, every organ, every gland in the body, and calcium is no exception. We already talked about salt. Tap water, because it contains sodium fluoride, which can interfere. Carbonated beverages, which are high in the phosphorus, and those can interfere. And then there's some medications like glucocorticoids, beta blockers, and protein pump inhibitors. And I see a connection whenever I see, if I don't see both of these listed, I'm always making the assumption. When stress affects a reaction, glucocorticoids are going to affect the reaction, generally speaking, because they have a similar effect to elevated cortisol. So that's the things that deplete calcium. So when you're working with people, you want to get a really good list of their diet and what they're taking in, especially if they're telling you that they've been diagnosed with osteopenia or osteoporosis. So alcohol, tobacco, herbicides and pesticides, all of the sugars, prolonged stress, table salt, tap water, carbonated beverages, medications. Okay, so we went through all that. So what nutrients, how do nutrients interact? There was a study early on that this is a very small study, but 10 men and women found that 600 milligrams of calcium consumed with a meal have the absorption of zinc from that meal. So there haven't been any studies that have done too much in the general intake, but I would definitely think about that in terms of the taking supplements together. How does calcium interact with iron? Well, it decreases iron absorption from non-heme sources. And as we talk about in our iron presentation, there's two main types of iron, heme and non-heme. Heme is the type of iron that's connected with myoglobin or hemoglobin, thus the name heme. And then that's usually found in animal products like meat. And then, of course, we have the non-heme sources, which are all our plant sources and some of the other things like dairy. It's important to take iron supplements 2 hours apart from calcium rich to maximize iron absorption. So there's another one. So we don't want to take zinc together with calcium, and we don't want to take iron together with calcium. Okay, what kind of things can cause calcium deficiency? Well, deficient soil. We already talked about processed food. Fluoride in the water, so the halogens antagonize. Certain foods that antagonize calcium, which are high protein foods, tannins, oxalates, and phytates. Excess mineral antagonists, phosphorus and carbonation, fat malabsorption, decreased GI transit time. Okay, we see that a lot of people have constipation is huge. Various kinds of drugs, including diuretics, the infamous alcohol and tobacco, and then deficiencies of D3, K2, and magnesium, very commonly seen in conjunction with calcium deficiency. Okay, so let's look at the impact of calcium deficiency. These are some symptoms. These are some conditions. These are going to be some interactions with other body systems and glands. Well, somebody has a lot of muscle weakness with insomnia, muscle cramping and spasms, also known as tetany. They've got an issue with kidney stones. If they've had some conditions in pregnancy, like preeclampsia or eclampsia, gestational diabetes, and hypertension, so those pregnancy issues are definitely can occur as a result of calcium deficiency. type 2 diabetes, colorectal cancer, polyps, fatigue, restless legs, and irritability and nervousness. So all of these are global impacts of the lack of calcium in the body, or decreased amount of calcium in the body. So another impact, big one, is heart palpitations. So, you don't jump right to calcium deficiency when you hear heart palpitations. There's a lot of questions you want to do to rule out other sources, but it's certainly on the list. And if it comes along with PMS, dysmenorrhea, or painful periods, painful menstruation, high blood pressure, hypertension, sensitivity of the nerves, so, touch people and they get that kind of feeling like they're overstimulated. Nerve sensitivity. So some people say, oh, my nerves hurt. What does that mean? Well, they're very sensitive along the nerve roots. Muscle twitching, that happens. Brittle nails, numbness, stiffness, tingling of hands and feet, which is called paresthesia, and convulsions. Any of these can happen. Not all of them will happen. And because some of these happen, it doesn't mean necessarily it's caused by a calcium deficiency, but it certainly could be, and it's easy enough to check out. How else? So these are symptoms you're going to see people come in and you may not even be thinking calcium, but it can be related. Depression, obviously osteopenia, osteoporosis, and tooth decay, we do think calcium. PMS and menstrual cramps, I usually think magnesium deficiency, but it can be calcium. When somebody's just overweight and can't get rid of it, it could be calcium. They have slow detoxification pathways, bone pain, delayed healing, slow healing of fractures and rickets. Let's move on and look more at how you can assess people for it. Within the program, we have a nutrient assessment chart. It's in the history taking. And in there, we have lists of deficiency signs for each of the nutrients. So you can have your client fill it out, or you can fill it out with them to get a sense of where some of these imbalances lie. So in this particular case, these are symptoms that you might be seeing, and you can have them do the checklist. So you can use that form that we've given you, and that will allow you to have them fill out all their nutrient status stuff, like all these questions, and get an idea of where things might lie. So things like anxiety, brittle nails, cramps, delusions, depression, insomnia, irritability, nervousness, osteoporosis, palpitations, periodontal disease, rickets, tendency towards headache, tooth decay, and twitches. So none of these are big surprises. Based on what we've talked about so far, we're just encompassing this into a nice little handy-dandy checklist that you can work with somebody on. The dairy myth. The dairy myth is, you need milk for strong bones and teeth. You've got the milk mustaches on the billboards. You've got children being told that if they want strong bones, they need to be drinking plenty of milk. In reality, Americans drink a lot of dairy. It's among the highest in the world, and we also have the highest osteoporosis rate. So clearly, osteoporosis is not a dairy deficiency. So when you double your animal protein, it causes a 50% loss in calcium due to the highly acidic pH state that it induces. So if you've got somebody who's drinking a lot of milk, which is animal protein, by the way, they're also eating, burgers and fries and things like that at McDonald's, or they're eating the standard American diet, they're going to be very high in animal protein, they're going to be high in dairy, and this is going to be draining their bones. There's basically milking their bones. Or like, okay, let's get rid of this milk, this calcium out of your bones. So it's a myth. If you look at the chart, it shows you different places and where how much hip fracturing calcium is consumed versus hip fractures and then calcium consumption, right? So that's that. That's the myth of dairy, and a lot of people believe it. My mother-in-law was addicted to her dairy because she thought it was saving her bones. And then she got osteoporosis and wondered why. Every day she drank her 2 cups of milk. Every day she drank her 2 cups of milk. It's just not going to cut it, considering all the other nutrition that goes into it. So you may be wondering, how do I test for calcium? If the serum level is not going to work, how do I test for it? Well, we look at the serum level, and if the serum level is out of balance, there are things you need to look at if it's abnormal, because you want to rule out like a parathyroid tumor or something like that. So you look at ionized calcium, you look at the urinary calcium, you look at phosphorus, magnesium, vitamin D3, what's their protein status, what's their parathyroid level even, and another one called parathyroid-related peptide. If the serum level is abnormal, these are the other things you look at. Generally, you look at it when those are high. But that's not going to give you an idea of the bone status. That's not going to give you an idea of how much calcium is in the tissues where they need to be and how much calcium that shouldn't be, the calcium salts that get deposited into the joints and can cause problems. So there are some functional tests. SpectraCell does a white blood cell analysis of all the nutrients. You could run that. NutriVal by Genova and Metametrics combined, they have a lab that you can run. If you want to know not so much how much calcium is there, but how the functioning is happening, you can do an NTX test, N-heliopeptide test. And they basically are measuring for metabolites in the urine of bone breakdown. And we're comparing it to a baseline. The other thing is questionnaires. You just ask questions, have them fill out questionnaires, and get a good idea. I also wanted to mention OsteoNex, which is, again, a turnover, bone turnover test that you can do through. I think Genova Diagnostics does that one. There's no routine biochemical method that appears to assess calcium status accurately, however. Okay, so functional tests are the way you want to go. So assessing bone mineral density, well, you want to look for signs of porousness in the bones. You want to look for signs of osteoporosis or osteopenia. So the tests that are done for that are the DEXA, dual energy x-ray absorptometry, is one of the best tools, and you can scan it at two different sites. So you oftentimes do it in the hip and the wrist. And you get a baseline. Like these tests don't mean a lot without seeing a baseline. You can do CT scans, but it's actually less precise and less accurate than the DEXAs. I've never run those. I've never actually seen a report from one of those. I have, on the other hand, seen a lot of DEXAs. So RDA for calcium, I mean, they keep raising it. They keep raising it and raising it. Look what it is for a 71-year-old woman. It used to be 800 for adults. It used to be 800 straight. But look, even males, they're having them do that much. And, you know, males aren't as prone to osteoporosis because of the hormones. They don't have the menopause and the drop in estrogens like we do. So it's really high. I'm not sure I agree with it. You certainly want to make sure the person's getting enough if they're pregnant or lactating, but you don't want it to contribute to deposition anywhere in the body. So a lot of, those numbers are high. 1,000 milligrams for a 4 to 8 year old, that's really high. Hypercalcemia. What does that mean? Too much calcium in the blood. Now, we know that if a little bit is good, more is better, right? Wrong. Right? It's not a little bit as good as more is better. It's the Goldilocks principle. We need to have the exact right amount. So if we get too much calcium in the blood, it can actually lead to negative side effects. And in fact, some of the side effects can be deadly. So what do they say is the maximum upper tolerable limit? It's not much more than what they're saying is the safe one for children. Anyway, they're having kids 1 to 8. Well, actually, it goes up a little higher. I'm sorry. It's the babies they're saying is a safe upper limit is 1,000. But, you know, that seems to be, to me, a very high amount. And I'd be wary of anybody that's taking that much calcium in. Okay. Generally speaking, somebody is not going to get hypercalcemia if they're taking in their calcium through calcium-rich foods, even if they are taking in excessive of this upper limit. And mainly, they're going to get it from taking the supplements. And there's a condition that has resulted as a result of large quantities of calcium supplements in conjunction with, guess what, antacids. So what if some of the docs telling people to do? Take Tums for calcium. What's Tums? An antacid. So they're setting them up for hypercalcemia. So this seemed to be happening a lot more when people were told when they had ulcers to have large quantities of milk with calcium carbonate and sodium bicarbonate as antacids. And this is actually a condition that was coined calcium alkali syndrome, also known as milk alkali syndrome. And it's associated with taking calcium supplement levels from 1.5 to 16 grams per day for 2 days to 30 years. Holy cow! Is that a range or what? So here they're saying the tolerable upper limit is like 3,000 for an adult, right? But then they're saying that the range is above between 1.5 and 16 grams, which is a huge range. How do we know where that falls? How do we know what really safe is? For from 2 days to 30 years. So that to me is an irresponsible kind of a recommendation to make. So I think that we go with Goldilocks, right? The just right. Where do people need to lie? I think if you keep people from going much above the RDA, you're probably going to be safe. Do they need the RDA? They may not. If they could modify their diet and get rid of a lot of those acid-forming foods so that they can have the kind of intake that they find in peoples in Japan and other places where they eat more of their native diet. Who's at most risk for hypercalcemia? Postmenopausal women, pregnant women, transplant recipients, patients with bulimia, patients on dialysis, and patients using diuretics. Now let's just look back at this number for postmenopausal women. We have to figure out that's 51 and older, so around 2,000, because those are the highest risk for hypercalcemia. They don't mention pregnant in here, but most pregnant women are going to be in the range of, well, some of them are unfortunately between 14 and 18, but 19 and 50. So just really be careful with the people who are saying, yes, I need to take plenty of calcium, and especially the ones that are taking Tums for calcium. Let's look at some of the risks with hypercalcemia. So let's look at hypercalcemia symptoms. Mild hypercalcemia, just a little bit high, can be asymptomatic, so you don't even have any symptoms overtly, but they could have loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, constipation, abdominal pain, fatigue, frequent urination, hypertension. Well, geez, that could be caused by anything, right? So how would you know? So watch them do intakes. Make sure you're watching what they're taking in, because it's unlikely to come from purely dietary alone, unless it's a combination of lots and lots of milk with the antacids. So you're wanting to just use this as, oh, they have these symptoms. Let's ask them, are they one of these people who just are on this calcium more is better bandwagon? It's possible to see it. In severe hypercalcemia, we've seen prostate cancer and cardiovascular disease, but also confusion, delirium, and coma, and even death if not treated. So this is serious stuff, very serious stuff. And it's unlikely that you're going to see this, but you always want to make sure that you have this in mind when you're asking people questions. So what's the best way to give people calcium? Well, food, obviously. Herbs, a lot of herbs that are really good sources of calcium. Oral supplementation, and we'll look at the different types. You can do intravenous or intramuscular. That's usually in the form of calcium gluconate. And then there are topical patches that have vitamin D3, K2, magnesium, and calcium. So all of these are methods that you can take and get somebody to increase their calcium intake. I like food and herbs first. So here's some good sources from food. Greens are huge. Tofu and other soy products. I prefer fermented soy if the person's going to use soy. Good sources of calcium. Bok choy, figs, sardines, beans, oranges. But as I said before, oranges are, they have about 80 milligrams of calcium per orange, which is not shoddy. Broccoli is a good source. Any of the stuff from the sea, like kelp and nori, almonds and sesame seeds. So it's not hard to get calcium-rich foods. We've got a resource for you. If you go into the Vibrant Living Members side of the website and you go to two places, if you're in Mastery and Certification, you'll see it in two places. If you're just in the Foundations program, you'll only see it in one. But in Foundations, in the Foundations module under Nutrition, there's an Eating for Bone Health. And we have a really nice article, and we have some recipes there. We have a link to a video where we share some really good recipes for bone health, where we combine some of these ingredients and some of the herbs I'll show you in a minute to create these really bone-supporting foods, right? So I didn't mean to make light of the fact that osteoporosis is serious, right? It is a serious condition, and there are lots of folks that suffer from it, and we do need to be really careful about making sure people get enough calcium and all the other nutrients, and that's what we give you in that piece. So I would highly recommend that as a supplement to this particular presentation that you go to the Eating for Bone Health in the Foundations part of the Vibrant Living member site. And also, if you're in the upper level program, the certification program, you should see a whole thing on bone health in as a whole module, a whole separate little program that goes through that. I think there's one like that, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, that video is just, it's great because it's got a video and a recipe guide, and it's going to give you ideas on how you can help your people to avoid them having to do these drugs that don't really do a whole lot. The osteoporosis drugs like Fosamax, which they're very disruptive to the gut and the digestive tract, but they also are just good at thickening the bones, but not necessarily making them stronger. So dangerous medications. So here's another list. Look at all these herbs. Like, you can have so much fun with these herbs. Nettle leaf is loaded with it. Oat straw, alfalfa, horsetail. They also are high in silica, which is very supportive of bone health. But even the fun stuff that we use in our kitchens, the basil and savory and marjoram and dill. I eat a lot of dill. Dill and garlic, I love that together. Thyme and chervil and dandelion, and it's good for the liver as well. Parsley, sage, peppermint, oregano, celery seed, capers, coriander, cinnamon, rosemary, tarragon, fennel seed, poppy seed, bay leaf, cumin, caraway, cloves, anise, curry, and cardamom. All of those are really good sources. Here's food sources. The link is there to the WH Foods list. I just copied part of it out there, but that gives you the top sources. And I love those lists that WH Foods has for just about all the nutrients. Forms of calcium and supplementation. There's the mineral salt form carbonate, very low absorption. The acid complexes, organic salts, these are better absorption. Citrate, lactate, gluconate, malate, ascorbate, citrate, malate. And I have a chart that'll share with you like a little bit of tidbits about each one of those. And then the amino acid complexes, which tend to be the best absorbed, but also the most expensive. Glycinate, lysinate, orotate, and taurate. And you'll see they're similar to the ones that are done for magnesium as well. So carbonate is the least expensive. It's the least bioavailable, requires a very good intact HCl in the stomach, should be taken with meals for best absorption. A calcium citrate and citrate malate can be taken any time, and they can benefit people with insufficient HCl because they don't require the level of HCl that the carbonate needs, but they still have a pretty low bioavailability, about 20% elemental calcium. Lactate is medium bioavailability because it can be absorbed at various pHs, and it's found in aged cheese and baking powder. That sounds yummy. Calcium ascorbate is calcium plus ascorbic acid, and that's a much higher absorption. And the upside of that is you're also getting the ascorbate with it, the vitamin C. A calcium lysinate has actually been shown to activate certain digestive enzymes like lipase and calm the stomach. So this could be something if you've got someone who you're dealing with osteoporosis, osteopenia, some other signs of low calcium, and they also have some digestive issues with fat or they're missing their gallbladder, that could be really helpful. Calcium taurate is combined with taurine for vascular health, but also taurine is a precursor to GABA. So there's a lot of benefits to taking the amino acid complex calciums. Calcium glycinate is extremely bioavailable, 180% better absorbed than calcium citrate, and 21% better than citrate malate. So that's hugely. So if somebody's looking at the price, they have to look at the availability and the amount they're getting, because if they're just looking at price and not absorption, they're missing the boat, okay? You can be peeing away or just eating stuff that's not getting absorbed and wasting money. And then calcium orotates. Orotates are cool because they help create the DNA and RNA, and they can penetrate into the cell membranes and deliver the actual ionized calcium to the innermost layers of the mitochondria and the nucleus of the cells. So that form is very bioavailable. Topical calcium. We don't think about that much. We think about topical magnesium, but topical calcium is actually an ancient remedy. They used to do milk baths and yogurt facials. Some people still do yogurt facials. You can also get topical calcium absorbate for receding gums. Now, that could be really helpful to just be able to rub that in. We know vitamin C is super important for collagen tissue and for gums, and a lot of people who have low vitamin C have bleeding gums, so that could be a good thing as well. You can get a calcium gel that's a 2.5% for burns, chemical burns, it's been mostly useful for. And then patches that contain carbonate, which is going to get in better than having it go through your belly, magnesium D3 and K2. Okay, so it just shows a picture of the calcium getting into the cells. And we have one more thing to talk about, and then we are going to close. But it's critical that you maintain the calcium-magnesium ratio. 1.1 to 2.1, with calcium being twice that of magnesium at the max. So you should not ever have anybody taking more than twice as much calcium as magnesium. And I see this a lot. People are taking their calcium supplement and they're taking their 1400 a day, like the RDA says, and they may only be taking 350 of magnesium. Combine that to the fact that they are eating a diet that might be high in dairy products or other foods that are high in calcium, but not high in greens, which contain the magnesium as well. So it's really, really important that you look at this ratio, especially if you have somebody who's showing signs of low magnesium. It may not be that they have too little magnesium. It may be that they have too much calcium. So watch that. You know, it's really important that people who are osteoporotic, osteopenic, they're told they need to get their calcium up. They're on the bandwagon, but they're missing the other 20 nutrients that are required. So it's really important for you as a holistic nutrition practitioner that you go in and you help them to make sure that they're getting the right balance with magnesium and calcium, but also all the rest of those nutrients that are needed for bone health. And we do go into detail in that Eating for Bone Health class that I highly recommend that you watch. And then without sufficient magnesium, the calcium can infiltrate soft tissues. Now, that can cause atherosclerosis if they infiltrate the arteries, right? We see that calcium plaques build up all the time in people and they have heart attacks. Calcium deposits wherever, like some people have calcium deposits in their joints, in particular soft tissue areas, and arthritis. So this can be an issue. Really watch that calcium-magnesium ratio. This is something that you can help people to control because they may not be looking at all the different places that they're getting the calcium. And if they're not eating a diet so rich in magnesium, they're going to get out of balance. So we have a list of references, and I appreciate your attention. You can always look things up if you want to go deeper. And this was like a little over an hour presentation on an overview, giving you a lot of things to think about, a big understanding of the metabolism of calcium. But of course, you could go much deeper, and I've given you resources to do that. So thank you so much for being here.